Well, my freshman year of college, I looked like that. I was a mess, inside and out. I hadn't showered for that entire summer, thinking I was somehow getting closer to nature. I would use the sand off the bottom of the lake to wash my hair, and this is what you get. I thought I was getting closer to nature, I was really just getting stinkier. But not long after this picture, a friend asked me if I wanted to get some free pizza at a Bible study. I went for the pizza, but I left understanding the gospel. And over the next 3 years, my non-believing roommates had front row seats to watch me transform from a guy who would break beer bottles over his head to a guy who loved the Lord. And on our last night together, we were being evicted from our house for having house parties. One of my roommates, ironically named Christian, begged me to turn back into the old Ryan just one last time. And I told him, it's just not my thing anymore. That's not who I am. He tried one more time, and then he broke down sobbing. And he said, I want what you've got. That night, that moment, changed the trajectory of my life. All this time, I had thought that my roommates resented what the Lord had been doing in me. But deep down, they actually wanted what I had. And for the first time, I lifted up my eyes and saw that the harvest is ready. It's ripe for the picking. And he was calling me to go. Good morning, Rock Hill. My name is Ryan Kesselhohn. This morning is Global Missions Sunday. We're going to examine three passages from Matthew that reveal Jesus' call to go into the harvest, two paths to take, how to participate in it, and what it looks like when ordinary people say yes to this extraordinary invitation. So let's begin where Jesus ends, with his very final words on earth to his disciples in Matthew 28:18. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And surely, I am with you always to the very end of the age." Now, I want us to notice something crucial about how Jesus frames this great commission. He doesn't begin with a command. He begins with a claim. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. This is an absolutely staggering assertion. Jesus is claiming total, comprehensive authority over everything that exists, heaven and earth, spiritual realm, physical realm, past, present, and future, angels, demons, nations, individuals, your plans, your life, your money, your home, your children, your parents, everything. Think about what this means. When Jesus says go, he's not making a suggestion as a spiritual teacher. He's not offering advice as a moral philosopher. He's issuing a directive as the sovereign Lord of the universe, the one who spoke galaxies into existence and who holds molecules together by the word of his power, who numbers every hair on our heads. That person is telling us what to do. And here's what's remarkable. He doesn't stop with the command. Let's look at what comes after. Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. Do you see the bookends? At the beginning, his authority, and at the end, his presence. The one who has all authority promises to be with you always. This isn't some military general sending you into battle and then returning to the safety of his headquarters. This is the king who says, I'm going with you every step, every day, to the very end. Now, let's look at the command, go make disciples of all nations. The word disciple is best understood as an apprentice, someone who's learning to live and work like their master. Jesus isn't asking us to get people to pray a prayer or attend a service. He's asking us to help people become little versions of himself, to teach them to think like Jesus, love like Jesus, prioritize like Jesus, spend money like Jesus, and treat enemies like Jesus. And where are we supposed to do this? All nations. Literally, all ethnic groups, all people, all tribes and languages. This is a global, multi-generational, multi-ethnic mission. It's not complete until representatives from every tribe, tongue, and language are worshiping around the throne. How do we do it? He says baptism first, which is publicly identifying them with Christ's death and resurrection, welcoming them into the new family of God. And secondly, by teaching them to obey everything he commands, not just intellectual knowledge, but life transformation. Here's what also struck me about the passage. This is an invitation from someone way above our pay grade asking us to help him. Think about that. The King of Kings, who needs nothing, who can accomplish his purpose with a word, chooses to use us. He invites us into this mission, and let me tell you, for me, this has been one of the best decisions I made. Here's what it looked like for me. After my roommate broke down crying, my life plans switched from being a teacher to full-time ministry. I started working with college students and athletes at UW La Crosse. 3 years later, I met Laura on campus. We got married, and together we dove into full-time ministry with the Jesus film. As newlyweds, we converted an old school bus into a camper, saved a bunch of money, and drove down to Orlando to work with the Jesus film. We spent those first 3 years making films in about 75 languages from about 40 countries. Many of those were countries I had never heard of before, places like Benin, Suriname, Vanuatu. Exhausted from travel and wanting to start a family, we then moved to Duluth for campus ministry on the 13 schools in the greater Twin Ports. After that, we jumped back into the Jesus film, but this time we brought our kids with us. So in brief, over the last 30 years, we've transitioned from full-time to part-time to volunteer. And right now, we can't really go overseas, not easily anyway, because we have obligations with our adult foster care job. But we're still involved, sending people, and already we're thinking about how we could maybe go again in retirement. So my point is, wherever we are in life, there's a way for us to be a part of this mission. But honestly, it's not even about going overseas. Most of us are not going to be going. That's not the most important part. I think that many people could go and should go. But what Jesus really wants us to do is to surrender and be willing to do whatever he asks. That brings us to our next passage in Matthew 16. Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? Now, on the surface, this sounds like bad news, doesn't it? Deny yourself, take up your cross, lose your life. This doesn't sound like the abundant life that Jesus promised elsewhere. But look more carefully at what Jesus is actually saying. He's presenting us with two paths, and he's revealing the shocking truth about each one. Path one, try to save your life. Hold on to it. Keep it safe, comfortable, and under your control. Path two, lose your life for Jesus' sake. Let go. Take risks. Follow Jesus into something that might be dangerous, costly, or uncomfortable. And here's the great reversal. Path one, the one that looks safe, actually leads to losing your life. Path two, the path that looks dangerous, actually leads to finding your life. This is the great paradox of the kingdom. It's completely counterintuitive to everything our culture tells us. Let me show you what this looks like in real life. I want to tell you about two men I know who illustrate this paradox perfectly. I have a friend, John, who lived in Duluth. He's my age. He retired 20 years ago at age 32. He lives on a sailboat, travels the world kiteboarding. He's good-looking, rich, and has lived a life of only leisure for the last 20 years. The problem is that wealth, freedom, and adventure are his God. And 2 weeks ago, in utter despair, John took his own life. Jesus' words are devastating in their accuracy. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Now let me tell you about a second man. Laura and I met a Christian lawyer in the deeply Muslim country of Uzbekistan. For safety reasons, just to visit him, we needed to walk separately and take zigzag routes throughout the city and making sure that no one was following us to get to his office. When we met him, his eyes beamed with joy. He told us he defends Christians, persecuted Christians, and that has put a big target on his back. He got excited as he told us to go into the bathroom and look for anything unusual. I went in there, and it was a totally normal bathroom. Then he showed me that a towel bar had a secret latch that opened a door, and there was earthen steps that went down into a basement dug out about twice the size of the bathroom. Down there were stacks of forbidden Christian materials. He told us he dug that out over years, filling his pockets with dirt and emptying it outside, so he knew that this would be an undetected room. Do you see the stark difference in these two men? Both made choices about what to live for. One had everything the world promised will make you happy, but in the end, it left him empty and desperate. He tried to save his life, and he lost it. The other man risked everything, even his life, for something eternal, and his eyes shone with life. He lost his life for Jesus' sake and found it. So here's the question Jesus is putting before us. What are we living for? Are we trying to save our lives, clinging to comfort and security? Or are we willing to lose our lives for Jesus' sake? to take up our cross and follow him into something potentially dangerous, costly, and eternally meaningful. This raises an obvious question. What does this kind of life look like? Well, that brings us to our third passage in Matthew 9. So, with apprentices' eyes, let's look at Jesus. Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Notice what Jesus is doing here. He's not sitting in one location waiting for people to come to him. He's going to them, traveling from town to town, teaching the good news of the kingdom, and having compassion on the people. He's meeting real needs, both physical and spiritual. And this is important. There are many ways to fulfill the Great Commission: teaching, preaching, healing, feeding people, building houses, digging wells, writing computer programs, countless of other helpful things. You can follow God's call by doing the thing he's gifted you to do, all as a means of sharing the gospel. Let's look at Jesus' motivation. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. The Greek word for compassion here literally means his guts were wrenched. It's a visceral gut-level response to human suffering and lostness. Jesus looks at people and sees their true condition: harassed and helpless, wandering without direction, vulnerable to predators, destined for destruction. And then notice what he says: "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few." This is crucial. Jesus is saying that people are searching. They're hungry. They want what you have. That's not the problem. The problem is that the laborers are few. The need is enormous, and the workers are insufficient. So what does Jesus tell his disciples to do? Does he guilt them? Does he manipulate them? No. He tells them to pray. "Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." In other words, ask God to send workers. And here's the implication: you and I are the answer to that prayer. Jesus is telling people to go. But I think sometimes the problem is that we think we need a special invitation. Unless we hear an audible voice, plan A is always to get a job in the secular world. Maybe if we see something in the foam on top of our latte, then maybe we'll consider going. Let me tell you a story that illustrates how backwards we've gotten this. On one of our Jesus film trips, Laura and I walked deep into the bush of Africa carrying our recording equipment to record the Edo language. When we finally got there, the village was singing and dancing as we arrived. They were about to get the first movie in their language. But first, we needed to get the blessing of the chief just to enter his village. We walked up to his mud hut, pushed aside the tattered fabric door, and entered into the darkness. There sat the big shirtless chief with his feet painted red. He believed that if he wore a shirt, he would die. I was supposed to crawl toward him with my eyes down and lift up my hands, my cupped hands, to his mouth to see if he would blow his blessing into them. Thankfully, he did. And then he handed me a big rope of plantains and a Coca-Cola. It's bizarre, isn't it, that Coca-Cola is found in the deepest parts of Africa. They have done with sugar water what Jesus wants us to do with the gospel. In fact, their mission statement, Coke's mission statement, is that the world every morning wakes up thirsty and there should be a Coke within arm's reach. But the sad part is every year, 10,000 people from around the world wait in line eagerly for a job for the Fortune 5 company Coca-Cola. But in that line of 10,000 applicants, 1,000 of them are followers of Jesus who are ready and willing to give the best years of their lives to making the world diabetic. Meanwhile, the King of Kings is asking us to join him in the greatest work in the universe, and he can't get his followers to consider this as a real job. What if we flipped that around here at Rock Hill? What if the assumption was, if at all possible, my plan A is going to give the best years of my life to the Great Commission, but if I get a special call to go work for Coke, great, so be it. Be the best Coke employee you can. But it's not going to be easier. Don't go to work for Coke because you think it's going to be easier. We all understand that because most of us work for the proverbial Coke company. It's important work. But there are many Rock Hillers who have made the switch and decided to try to bring the gospel to the dark corners of the earth. There are three examples that we'll look at right now. The first couple was sitting right out here 6 years ago, Chase and Michelle, with their two little girls, Charlotte and Luella. A missionary couple had visited their city group and shared about a need in the Balkans, an area of Eastern Europe. Chase and Michelle thought, God has equipped us to do helpful things there. Chase is an engineer and Michelle's a teacher. Well, when people heard that they were thinking about that and would like to go check it out, people gave money so that they could go for a week and check it out. They fell in love. And in 2021, with COVID masks on their face, we sent them from Rock Hill to the Balkans. Michelle has been a teacher at the school, and Chase switched his plans from being an engineer to planting a church. We now have a little Rock Hill church in the Balkans. Laura and I visited, and it's exciting. So don't count yourself out just because you've got little kids. Honestly, it's a great time to go. But if you can't, that's fine too. But I just ask parents, let's raise our kids believing that serving the Lord full-time would be a great job. Our second couple is Alex and Gavin Fries, newlyweds who attended our city group. Alex is an amazingly talented violinist who went to Estonia to complete her music degree. Gavin, her husband, works remotely for a marketing company. I knew that they wanted to be involved in international ministry, so I encouraged them, don't rush back to the U.S. after Alex's schooling is done, but consider going and visiting Chase and Michelle. They did. They saw the work, fell in love with it, and have decided to stay. Alex now works as a music teacher at the international school, and Gavin continues to work remotely, but in his spare time, he helps Chase plant that little rock hill in the Balkans. You can hear more about their stories, both of their stories, tonight at 5:30 at the Superior Campus. But in addition to those stories, you're going to hear from other Rock Hillers who are helping the persecuted church. They're helping distribute Christian books. They're discipling Brazilian women. They're setting up radio towers, running orphanages, and many other stories. Our third couple is Ralph and Julie Silkey. Ralph was a microbiology professor at UWS for many decades. Even though his hands were tied for ministry in the classroom, Ralph and Julie helped Laura and I start an international student ministry at UWS. About 70 international students from countries like Pakistan and China would meet monthly for a meal and a gospel message. Some of those students would become Christians and go back to their home countries. Other international students decided to stay here. One of them who stayed was this skinny kid from India. Laura met him 17 years ago at UMD. He was from a Hindu background, but had many questions about the gospel during a book study that we were hosting. You know what? You might know him. Does Abhi Devaredi ring a bell? He became a Christian, decided to stick around Duluth, get married, have cute little kids, and is even one of our very own deacons at Rock Hill. Well, back to Ralph and Julie. Ralph chose to retire early from UWS as a microbiology professor so that he and Julie could travel 4 months a year to China, Ethiopia, and Kenya, where Ralph continued his work as a biology professor, and Julie met with lots of the women at each campus where they were living. They could have been spending their retirement collecting seashells in Florida, but they found more fulfillment collecting souls for heaven. And lastly, two important things that are often forgotten. We need to give and pray so that others can go. If some of these Rock Hillers tell us they're thinking of going, let's help them get there. I can't move to Albania right now, but maybe you can. If you're willing to go, will you please ask me for financial support? I spend too much time on Facebook Marketplace looking at junk I don't need. And if you don't ask me, I'm going to buy another cheap snowmobile. So we need to be giving. If you're willing to go, we will help you get there. And prayer partners. Having a prayer team is the power behind every missionary's endeavor. They're going to have barriers that need our prayers. Physical, spiritual, monetary, relational. So let me bring this full circle. In Matthew 28, Jesus gave us the Great Commission. Go make disciples of all the nations. It's not just a command from someone with authority. It's an invitation from the King who promised to be with us always. That's our mission. In Matthew 16, Jesus showed us the great paradox. When we lose our lives for Jesus' sake, we find it. The lawyer in Uzbekistan found more life in a hidden basement with forbidden books than my friend found on a sailboat with unlimited freedom. And in Matthew 9, Jesus showed us what this practice looks like, or what it looks like in practice. He traveled, he taught, he healed, he met real needs. He called his disciples to lift up their eyes and see the harvest is ready. People are harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And then he said, pray for laborers. That's you. That's me. We're the answer to that prayer. This isn't about guilt. It's not even about going. But some of you will. This is about finding your life by losing it. This is about being a part of something so much bigger than ourselves that when you reach the end of your life, you'll look back with eyes shining like that lawyer in Uzbekistan, not with regret, but with joy that you gave your life to something worth dying for. Wherever you are, single and free, parents with little ones, raising teenagers, working remotely, or retired, there's a way for you to be a part of this. Lift up your eyes. The harvest is plentiful. The laborers are few. Jesus is inviting us to join him. So come tonight, Global Mission Night. Doors open at 5:45 at the Superior campus, not here. You're going to hear from many people who answered the call at different stages of life. It's going to be encouraging, and for some of us, life-changing. Let's pray. Dear Lord, King of Kings, we are humbled that you invite us to do this work. I think we're going to get to know a lot more about you the more we get involved. I pray that you would send many people here from Rock Hill to the world. And Lord, help the rest of us send them. Help us pray for them. Help us give money. And may there be little Rock Hills all over the world. In Jesus' name, amen.